Please silence or turn off your cell phones.
Good morning, everyone. Welcome, first Sunday in April, year 1912.
2012.
Yeah, please, 2012.
All right, 2012. So we're a little behind the time. But that's the case when you get to a certain point in time. You can't stop the clock, Charles. We would like to welcome visitors to the United Lodge of Theosophists in Philadelphia. And as is our custom, before we begin the meeting today, the topic of which is memory of past lives, mystery of mind. Before we begin, we'll give you a little small talk on just what the purpose of the ULT Lodge in Philadelphia and all the lodges located around the globe. It's all printed on this little pamphlet, which you can pick up as you come in. And also, you will find it on the table by the usher. The most important thing is that the policy of this lodge is independent devotion to the cause of theosophy without professing attachment to any theosophical organization. It is loyal to the great founders of the theosophical movement that does not concern itself with dissensions or differences of individual opinion. The work it has on the hand and the end it keeps in view are too absorbing and too lofty to leave it the time or inclination to take part in side issues. That work and that end is the dissemination of the fundamental principles of the philosophy of theosophy and the exemplification in practice of those principles through a truer realization of the self, a profounder conviction of universal brotherhood. It holds that the unassailable basis for union among theosophists, wherever and however situated, is similarity of aim, purpose, and teaching, and therefore has neither constitution, bylaws, nor officers. The sole bond between its associates being that basis, and it aims to disseminate this idea among theosophists in the furtherance of unity. It regards as theosophists all who are engaged in the true service of humanity without distinction of race or creed or sex, condition or organization, and it welcomes to its association all those who are in accord with its declared purposes and who desire to fit themselves by study and otherwise to be the better able to help and teach others. The true theosophist belongs to no cult or sect, yet belongs to each and all. And for your information, the associates you see or hear participating, being in sympathy with the purpose of this lodge, as set forth in its declaration, have recorded their desire to be enrolled as associates, it being understood that association calls for no obligation on my part other than that which I myself determine. That means that at the desk, as you come in the front room, you can ask, well, how does one participate? And all of that will be explained to you. As this little pamphlet shows, there are at least 28, or possibly more, lodges situated all around the world. The program is carried on here in this room on Sundays and Wednesdays. Today, as you noted, we began at 11 o'clock, but you can get in the front door by 10:30. The topic was mentioned, the mystery of mind for the month of April, and this being April the 1st, memory of past lives will be our topic. Now, on Wednesdays, the doors open at 5:30, so that you can come in and go to the library that you pass coming in. Libraries open from 5:30 to 7:30 Wednesday night, full of books, theosophical in other words, otherwise, and there'll always be someone in there, a volunteer, to help you get used to the volumes there, theosophical literature, and also find out what the topic will be for that Wednesday night. Library closes at 7:30. And as you come into this room, you'll see a book table there where you can peruse various theosophical literature, writings, and of course, the principal writings of H.P. Blavatsky and William Q. Judge, the founders of the theosophical movement in this part of the world in the 19th century. To make it a little more interesting, would like to inform you that there will be a symposium held Saturday, April the 28th, 2012. 11 a.m. to 4:30 p.m. at the Ethical Humanist Society of Philadelphia, which is located in 1906 Rittenhouse Square, right across the street. There'll be more information given out over the next few weeks, but you can always call here or visit our website at ultphiladelphia.org. This is a flyer listing the topics. We personally have attended several of these symposiums over time, and we guarantee that you will certainly be impressed by the enthusiasm and the topics discussed. For instance, on here it seems a pivotal moment in history. We see Alexandria, the pearl of the Mediterranean and the city of mind, modern theosophical movement. Here's something, successor to the Alexandrian eclectic school, the fundamental principles of theosophy, philosopher's alchemical stone and universal solvent. And of course, last but certainly not least, reincarnation and karma, the lost chords of hope and dignity. Signs of the time. So we think this will be available on the table over there for you as you leave. And as we personally have experienced several of these symposiums, you never attend one, you're in for a great surprise. All the work of this lodge is carried on, as stated, by voluntary contributions as to time, work, and also to keep the building open. It's a very valuable space, but we have to keep it viable, vibrant, and working. So all contributions of time, work, and money is appreciated and will be always appreciated. If you wish to find out how you can participate, stop at the desk and the volunteer at the desk will explain to you in detail some of the things that we do to keep the space alive. Before we begin our talk this morning, We have a few words from The Secret Doctrine, Volume 2, and you find it on page 424. Events which were never written outside the human memory, but which were religiously transmitted from one generation to another and from race to race, may have been preserved by constant transmission within the book volume of the brain. And through countless eons, with more truth and accuracy than inside any written document or record, that which is part of our soul is eternal. And what can be nearer to our soul than that which happens at the dawns of our lives? Those lives are countless, but the soul or spirit that animates us throughout these myriads of existences is the same. And though the book and volume of the physical brain may forget events within the scope of one terrestrial life, the bulk of collective recollections can never desert the divine soul within us. Whispers may be too soft, the sound of its words too far off the plane perceived by our physical senses, yet the shadow of events that were, just as much as the shadow of the events that are to come, is within its perceptive powers and is ever present before its mind's eye.
The bulk of collective recollections of it can never desert the divine soul within us. Its whispers may be too soft, the sound of its words too far off the plane perceived by our physical senses, yet it is there. So we are hopeful. And as we search for memory of past lives, we have to ask ourselves why we do this. It's a popular thing in psychic circles and spiritualistic meetings and so forth, and we have those who would claim to give you information from past lives or from loved ones who can transmit this information. But really, the overall title for the month is The Mystery of the Mind. And one of the things we can start with is memory. Now, we know, as a group that's been studying together for a while, that the sevenfold nature of man has four transitory parts to it, or principles, or elements, states of consciousness. And then it has the mind, the spiritual soul, and spirit. That mind is ever present, but the vehicle, or the instrument, or the costume, the body, it takes up in each new life changes. So the brain is connected with that transitory physical part. The mind is eternal, and that was brought out in the reading. So if we are searching in the physical brain brought into this life for use with this instrument we call the body, we'll never find it, because it was the brain for this lifetime, just like a previous brain for that lifetime funneled the memories of that lifetime. So memory, remembrance won't help us. Well, we know there's recollection. We can collect bits of something and put it back together. But again, those are bits of events of a lifetime. We want to recall something that happened in our youth. Perhaps we hear a piece of music and it brings part of a memory to mind. And then we see someone we haven't seen in a while. Oh, remember when? This is a recollection of pieces of memory, shall we say. But again, it's temporary. Those two types of memory are connected with the brain, which is not the same brain. It's a different brain with each incarnation. So where do we look for where the memory of all past lives, of all work, all experience is? Well, it tells us in the reading, that which is part of our souls is eternal. Now, theosophy would say, look for the soul in that higher trinity, the Atma, Buddhi, Manas in Sanskrit, or mind, spiritual soul, and spirit. Through the myriads of existences, that is ever the same. How do we prove that to ourselves? Well, there is something within us that never changes while all the parts of our lives and our experiences whirl around us. And Mr. Crosby says, change cannot see change. If you're part of the hurricane, you cannot fix on something. There must be something which never changes to witness those changes of our lives. That is that ever-present, eternal part of our nature that is the same for each of us. We can all say, I am. We are all part of the one divine unity. We are divine fragments, but we can all say, I am. That I has witnessed our youth, our middle age, going into our older age, all the changes of our body and face and hair, etc. So that witness is the preserver of all of the life experience, of all of the knowledge we have gained, of all the wisdom, hopefully, we have been able to transmute on higher planes and understand. So the direct perception of all of this would have to be from the inner, not from the outer and transitory. There is an innate faculty of recalling, and this is a particular, it says, particular quality of the soul. And to reach and exercise soul memory, we must first understand the real nature of man. If we are looking for it through a psychic or through our dreams or through the help of someone else, do you have any clue for me as to what I can learn from my past lives? We're looking in the wrong direction. And there is a roadmap evident to every one of us. Everything, Theosophy says, is an exact consequence of that which preceded it. Everything is a repetition of that which was, a return of impression. So to find who or what we might have been in a previous life, we look at who we are today. Do we have faculty with something? Does something come easy to us that others have to struggle for? And our learning, where perhaps we have done past learning, is there something we want terribly to understand and learn and have facility with, but just aren't able to? The vehicle we have is not fit for it, yet another does it with ease. So the return of these impressions of previous lives is what we are. It is exactly what we come into this life with. In every act of our existence, we are exhibiting true memory, whether we realize it or not. Did someone give us a blueprint for how to talk, or how to walk, or how to think, or see, or perceive? There's a soul memory that's alive within each of us that we each could have access to if we made it possible. Most of the time we're centered and looking in this plane that we are so familiar with and so comfortable with, the plane of the physical world, the material world. We are told also that every plane of consciousness has a memory of its own. Well, how could that be? Well, consciousness never ceases, but is continuously active. There is a continuity of that spiritual essence that goes on forever. Whether it is in the incarnated waking state of man, whether it is in the smallest pebble on the beach, whether it is a oneness in a state of rest. There is a continuity of consciousness. And we're told there is no record made in the physical instrument of the inner planes, for the brain has not been trained in that direction. Now, we said before, this physical brain is an instrument that is temporary, but we're told now we can train it, and we hear the phrase, make it porous. Make a connection between the firings of the brain to reach to the inner mind, to turn within and begin to understand who and what we are. That in us which is itself unchanging is the only thing that's real. So truly, the events of a past life or a future life are not important to us. They were the vehicles we had, and that comes under law, to work through whatever facility we had in a past life. We have the perfect set of vehicles and faculties and tools right now to work on what we need to do in this life and in the future, because it is under law. And we know that law so well, it is karma. So everything, it's that return of impression. Everything we set into motion at any moment in any lifetime will have its return. Everything in this lifetime is not the result exactly of our last lifetime, but rather this instrument we have is the fit instrument under the correct hereditary and the circumstances we know before we come in to be proper, to work out a certain set of karmic returns. They're not linear. I don't do this in this life and get the return in this life, necessarily. It's a correlation of what would be appropriate to be worked out in this life. So really, everything we are is a memory of a past life. But we would like to have a picture. We would like to think we were Prince Valiant, or a princess or a goddess, or we always imagine we were something wonderfully elevated. Guess what? We are. There's something in us that recognizes that and cognizes it as, I was something beautiful and elegant and spiritual. I still am. We still are. All the changes of substance and form are brought about by spirit and consciousness and expressed in various forms of life. We know that to be true. We study cycles. We know spirit is the activating force, the sustaining power, the elegant oneness from which everything emanates and comes into being. Spirit and consciousness expressed in all the forms of life. We are at the pinnacle, it is said, for this existence as man. The perfection of this would be the master, the Mahatma. And from where we are now up that ladder are many, many rungs of perfectibility. So there is a great, and this is the continuity we're talking about, there is the life that has yet to even come into incarnation. There is the life that has been here and perfected and gone on, or perhaps stayed to help us blossom. But there is forever a continuity, so we never need to be concerned about any past life. What we need to be concerned about is what we're doing with this one. The voice of the silence says, and this is something we didn't get until we read it again, mind is like a mirror. It gathers dust while it reflects. It needs soul wisdom to brush away the dust. So what we call the mind is the reflector. And we were thinking, how does it gather dust? Well, while we're worrying about things like past lives, we're reflecting on the past. There's dust gathering because we're not using the mind power, the gift that we've been given because it is our heritage. We are spirit in action. We need soul wisdom to brush away that dust, meaning we need to awaken to the fact that we are spirit in action, and we need to see that in every bit of life around us, from the ocean wave to our dog in the yard to our sunflower plant reaching up to the light, every bit of it. And so from one change of life to the next, death then will always be a great advantage, because if we didn't change these bodies and these temporary vehicles, there wouldn't be any chance for advancement. We would be stuck in a mire of impression. But we, as active spiritual beings, control all of that, every bit of that. There is only one thing in this life that can be retained permanently, and that is the spiritual nature, the great divine compassion, which may translate by the word love. So we can begin to see, and we can talk about, how we make ourselves porous to those spiritual, altruistic, loving thoughts and actions, because it all begins in how we think, in our ideas. The ideas we hold are the forecasters of how we will feel and how we will act. That will be the forecaster for what we can expect as a return in the future. So we're in charge of it all. How we use these spiritual powers is completely up to us. So your thoughts are invited? Yes.
So then it's not who we were, but what we were. So could we say our character might hold some of those answers?
Absolutely. Our character is sort of the blueprint. If we think of it that way. Our character is made up from tendencies that we have solidified, is not the right word, but worked on time and time again. Eventually, they become part of our character, and we hope that they're good parts of our character, but all of it comes through because we have made effort in a direction. So yes, in the terrestrial world, let's say, if we have a tendency toward quick temper, we have probably not in past lives been able to get a hold of that and work it through. So we know that's something we have earned to work on, and we have yet another chance to work on it. If we have a tendency towards geometric thinking, or biology comes to us in a flash, we have set work in that direction as well. But those tendencies of our character are blueprints of the past. Yes.
Yet those personal characteristics which define a character, they don't seem to be the same as soul character. Could we say soul character would be our attitude towards those tendencies,
yes,
what we do with them, how we use them, whether we take them personally or impersonally. So that is not of this one life.
Yes, so the soul character would be different. It would be how we respond to those things that we discussed a moment ago, anything of the physical plane that we can point to. And it also includes the soul powers that we have naturally earned and have the freedom of choice as humans with mind at least partially active, and we're working on that as well, direction that we give them is part of that soul character as well. That will come back to us. Yes, in the back?
It's interesting because, as was said in the beginning of the talk, there are so many people that go to different practitioners to try, you know, hypnotize back to a past life, reading cards or whatever. And we've heard, and we think it was Mr. G judge makes a comment about it, that it's a protection for us not to know what our past lives were, because we may not be able to handle, you know, the person that we, you know, it might upset us too much. And it's mm-hmm. it's like cheating on a test, because what your past life was, you're reaping those experiences now. And if we knew why we did something back then, it's not, we may not be able to learn a lesson now. So,
absolutely.
It, you know, it's a safety net.
Absolutely. And, you know, we're thinking about the reason why people seek out these helpers to learn this past life memory. It's usually from a dissatisfaction or a suffering. I don't understand why I have this in my life, because I didn't do anything to cause it, but yet I'm suffering with it. And we go to seek out any means to figure out why that's the case. Yet that same individual who has an ease and comfort in this direction, well, that must be due to me. But equally, there's no reason for it apparent. So it's often the struggling and the suffering that brings us there to figure out why this unmerited thing is happening to us. And the universe is ruled by law, which is an expression of perfect justice, and that is simply action and reaction. Now, we can't satisfy that seeker by saying, well, you can't know what the past life was, but we can perhaps offer them the idea that we know action and reaction to be a scientifically proven fact, and maybe if we think about that in our lives, perhaps these are some reactions or impressions we have to work out, and just let them think about it. But yes, the other point made was that we don't want to know what the past was, because it took a lot to get where we are. We've been working on this for 18 million years just to get here. Yes?
You said it that each life we have a new brain, so that these experiences that we think like deja vu, they're from another life. Well, that can't be possible, because it's a new brain, it's some other experience. When we go to sleep at night, do we have access to anything? I mean, any past lives or any experiences that we can't get in touch with on the physical side?
Yes, when we sleep at night and go through the various sleep states, it says every plane of consciousness has its own memory. So when we go into the dreaming state, that's the first state, and then there's a deep sleep state where that higher is free to commune on its plane of consciousness, or its natural plane. Wisps can be brought back, we know, through dreams if we are able to decipher them, and that takes practice. But also, in that whole process, the astral may have been in such a state that we were able perhaps to view something or to visit something, we call that in quotes. And that could be the deja vu, that this very intense dream we had, perhaps of being somewhere or seeing a place we hadn't seen before, then in life we see it. Well, the connection is that what we viewed on another plane is now being viewed on the physical plane. So that could be one explanation for deja vu. Another one could be a past life memory if it was extremely strong and we had a terrific attachment to it. If we come across it again, there may be again a wisp of that, a whisper that came through somehow. So your hand was up.
Yes. What is the impact of myth and fairy tales on past life memories in both individual and national, you know, affairs?
Myth and fairy tales, that struck us as the beginning of the reading, what that was. events which were never written outside the human memory, but which were religiously transmitted from one generation to another, or race to race, may have been preserved by constant transmission. So the myth, the allegory, the stories that our grandfather and great-grandfather passed on to us, all of that is wisdom that has been gained from experience that was had in the past. Now, in myth in particular, we see symbolized often that wisdom. So we have to do some work to decipher it. But again, it's a reminiscence, a soul reminiscence that, again, the thought that we were something high in a previous life could be the reminder that we are that within. So myth and allegory and symbol are reminders for us that these truths that exist, the one truth that exists, is planted, little seeds are planted everywhere, and it is for us to harvest that garden. Yes, in the back.
Well, it's not a question of what I was then, but what I will be. So, therefore, if our memory is blocked, does theosophy give us some keys whereby we may get in touch with the past or use in the present? Because it's what I will be.
Absolutely. So two parts there. What I will be, I am creating in every moment. I am continuously impressing the world around me, not only my mind and my feelings and my heart, but as I act and send those feelings and thoughts out, I'm impressing the world around me in all planes of existence. So in order to be fit to create a better life so that we are better able to help uplift all of the kingdoms, all of life, making ourselves porous to that inner spiritual wisdom is the key. And we're told loving deeds is the way to spiritual wisdom. Such a simple remedy. Loving deeds is the key to spiritual wisdom, spiritual knowledge. So if we begin to act, and we say act as if we were all connected. Act as if my brother would no more harm me than I would harm him. Act as if we're all on this journey together and we're all interconnected and interdependent and impressing one another at all times, and then decide how to proceed. We are then sort of opening a channel or a connection to that inner divine spiritual will that causes a much better result with that little bit of work done before we act. Check our ideas. Are they on the right track? Are they right? Is our motive right? What would be the best outcome in the way I could act? And having that flow down through action, that has its return and adds and uplifts all in its return. So it's making that inner available to that temporary brain. And we can do that by simply turning within. Yes.
On occasion with family members, the topic comes up because they know that I, you know, profess that reincarnation is, to me, it's logical, we'll put it that way. And we never want to sound like we're trying to sell something, like we're trying to convince someone against their will. Mm-hmm. It's much better to, as was said earlier, to drop a little seed if we can. But we've never used the argument of genius, and we think next time the topic comes up, because it did come up recently, the genius is how do you explain it? Then it's almost like, well, the onus isn't on me, it's on the person to explain genius. Mm-hmm. How can in one lifetime,
exactly,
especially child prodigies, like where did that come from?
Exactly.
You know, so.
And take it to nature as part of an explanation. We plant rose bushes, and every year that they come back and bloom, they're a little bit fuller and a little bit wider. They take up a little more space because they're growing. And if you consider a genius was once a seed, a rose bud, with time, with effort, over lifetimes, we now have the rose bush that takes up half the garden, the bloom, the full expression. So if genius is the full expression in one direction, usually mathematics or, you know, whatever the topic is, or even just in ways of seeing the world differently from others and therefore having better outcomes or different outcomes, we can correspond that to the flowering of something that took eons to create. And that would make sense logically. But yes, genius would be a great example of that. And again, we just love being across from the park at this time of year. Spring is here. The trees are blooming again. The buds are pushing up through the hard ground. And it is re-energizing and re-expressing itself in the natural cycle. That is who we are as well. Yes.
What does this theosophy have to say regarding to practice the golden rule? It would seem that we would have to be willing to give up our attachment to anything in any moment, and also to be willing to give up our aversion to anything. Because unless we're able to be completely present with another, we will come into this conversation, or we'll come into conversation with another with these preconceived ideas of how it is. Does theosophy have any suggestions regarding how to approach that?
Absolutely. And attachment, we think, is a very important subject with regard to this, because attachment is the blooming of something we have held onto with great effort. Whether it's attachment to something good or attachment to something bad we haven't worked out yet. Whatever it is, we are all attached in some direction. We hold something dear. We won't let it be taken from us. We will not give up the idea that this is true no matter what you tell me. And we are unwilling to sift through the wheat and the chaff to separate them. So that attachment can be a block, as was expressed. Little by little, we chip away at it by thinking and turning within and considering. Not believing, just considering, trying out ideas like this. Is there a oneness? Is there a spirit within? Am I my brother's keeper? When I look into another's eyes, do I see myself in them and them in myself? Give yourself exercises to do to chip away at that attachment. And when the cycle returns, it has that new impulse with it. So as we're able to do that, we're better able to live that golden rule. And theosophy does say, HPB says, if we would believe that my brother would no more harm me than I would harm him, 2/3 of the world's evil would disappear. It's an amazing statement. So even if we try to live the golden rule, we're heading in the right direction. And each time we meet a circumstance, we review and see perhaps, oh, maybe my motive was mixed here, or maybe I didn't quite get the result I wanted. Let me try it again differently and continue that. Then we will be better able to practice it, and those attachments will begin to fall away. Because we're told we're here for the work we have left to do, not as a dessert for something, but rather for what needs to be worked on. So that's a great idea. Yes?
Well, I think what we need to know is this is the human condition that we're in. And theosophy points to a definite direction of how we can be in the moment. Called the Bhagavad Gita. read chapter 2 and 3, you read it over and over again, and it's very straightforward, being single-minded, not looking for the results of one's mm-hmm. action, and giving everything up to the all, or to every, to all of life, that universal brotherhood. I'm not, so that's giving up attachment, and that's within the golden rule, but, you know, just being single-minded and not looking for the results or the rewards of our actions.
Absolutely. And start with I myself, nor thou, nor all the princes of the earth never were not, nor shall we ever hereafter cease to be. Have we ever really considered that we are eternal in our most inner nature? Think about that. We are eternal. We are never ceasing. Whether we are in expression or in oneness, in rest, we are eternal. We are electric, magnetic dynamos of energy, walking around believing we are this body and these thoughts and these feelings. So what we need to do is strip away little by little that which we have attached to as myself and begin to recognize the I that is in all. Yes.
Whenever I experience an effect in my life that I'm not really happy about, I'm at the point where clearly I take responsibility for everything and I recognize it was something that I had done in the past. So for me, it seems logical that being able to place what the cause of that was would have some productive benefit. So when something happens, I try to figure out, well, what did I do that precipitated this? And sometimes, to me, it can be obvious, you know, something I did in this lifetime. So for me, I want to know, like, if I can't figure out anything that I did in this lifetime to cause it, you know, that would be a reasonable reason to look back into a previous life. So I don't know if there's a kind of a response to that. You know?
First of all, you're on the right track. Because Theosophy offers the idea that we study and we explore and we use this practically, what we hear in these rooms, and that's exactly what was described. Let's take it to a universal level. If I receive an effect that in any way makes me suffer, however that might be expressed or felt, I have caused suffering at some time to another. It doesn't, the man of this lifetime wants to know why, but the soul understands the perfect justice that if I caused harm or hurt or suffering, I will receive the same in return in equal measure. The universe seeks to balance. So if we get a great serious return, we caused a great serious harm or suffering. What we can do with that is put equal force into something good that we send out. Use that learning to act that much better the next time we go to act. Does that help?
So don't worry about where the cause happens.
Exactly. Exactly. We really can't know. We really can't, let me rephrase that. Those who have been this way before and have progressed up that ladder of learning and spiritual discernment to the state of Mahatma or adept or, you know, elevated soul, elder brother, can see all the connections and understand that justice. We're just not there yet. We're seeing fragments. Not needing to know the specifics is simply a way to energize us to let go of that attachment, to need to know that, and just understand if this is a universe of law, this is due to me. So in order to work this out, all I can do is create a better tomorrow. I can use a better motive. I can express myself in a kinder way. Yes?
There's another good reason why it is
don't want to say futile, but why it's not such a good idea to try and figure out what exactly did I do in my past life to deserve what I'm doing now. Because if it is something that is something really bad, then you're going to have guilt feelings.
Mm-hmm.
And your guilt feelings are not going to help you advance. It's better to simply realize that, okay, I'm in this situation. Obviously, I've done something to deserve this. Now, how do I get out of this situation? How do I advance? And you gave some very good examples for that.
That's a good point. That guilt would create a whole other attachment.
Guilt sets us back.
Absolutely.
The guilt feeling.
Yes.
If we just take the explorations of this one life and try to understand the suffering we caused others, when we go back to it, we realize that it didn't seem so bad to us at the time. We really didn't know we were doing anything wrong. We thought we were doing the right thing. So even if we could remember the details of our past lives, upon looking at it, we may not...
Makes sense.
Well, what did I do wrong? I'm no further... closer to the truth that I am now. So what we really want to gain, as was said, is not the details of what we do, but the wisdom to understand why we act in certain ways.
Mm-hmm.
And we don't need to look in the past. We can understand that right now.
Absolutely. And see where else in our lives today that holds true. We may have part... thank you for all the hands. We'll get there. We may have part of our nature under control, but there is still some part of us that has not learned the discipline to act in the highest, most spiritual way. That's the stuff we're still working on. So we completely lost our train of thought, but okay. I think you were first here. No. Yes.
So then if we look on the other side of the coin and look at aspects of ourselves that are really, really positive. Like maybe one person, despite anything, is a very healthy person, or someone was born into incredible wealth. And is, well, the thing about that is it doesn't so much matter why this wealth came to him, or why a person happens to be very intelligent and is very accomplished academically with degrees. But what is important is if they are self-reflective, that they maintain a certain humility and sense of gratitude and willingness to use that positive strength for benefit of others. It really doesn't matter what he did in his past life to bring it on, as long as, you know, the heart and the head and the hands are all in line for good purpose.
Absolutely.
Similarly, we don't really even have to go into past lives for some of the really negative aspects that we might have found. It's very helpful, for instance, to find out, for a patient, of a psychologist, to find out why he has this personal disorder, and it may be a result of how he was treated when he was a child. That is that if it happened in that life, it's very helpful to find the source of that, because you can unravel it. It helps us understand it more. But if it is not possible to find out, because it did come in through from a past life, just knowing that perhaps it's because you're holding on to something negative could be, for instance, maybe an unwillingness to forgive that person. Well, you're never going to know who that person was.
Mm-hmm.
But if you practice the principle of forgiveness anyway, that's how nature works. It doesn't matter where, it doesn't matter where the seed is planted, but that the seed is planted,
mm-hmm.
so the principle of forgiveness will grow, and that can be very freeing.
Yes, and we're reminded of, we believe it was a quote from the Christian Bible, from those to whom much has been given, much will be expected. So there is always that balance of nature to keep in mind. Those with great wealth are often great philanthropists. And if we look at a reversal of fortune, it's very interesting study, way, way back in the corner.
It seems that what we have been talking about today in the topic, we can see how we are victims of our mea culpa attitude, fostered on us by our surroundings, our bringing up, and so forth. Non-identification would seem with the negative, we're not that. And when an individual listens in these rooms and develops that sense of detachment from the materiality of things going on around, then he perhaps will be able to even overcome the worst that he can imagine.
And Theosophy says if we fix just one problematic part of our nature in any lifetime, it has ramifications into the future like we can't imagine. Because if we consider that karma is ever rolling forward and gathering our actions, if we change just one element of our nature that needed working on, that has tremendous effect going forward. Way, way in the back.
We think if more people would just understand or accept the ideas of karma and reincarnation, it would negate the need to find out what it was because in our past lives, because the knowledge of karma and reincarnation, that way we would know the acceptance of what is happening in our lives now. And one thing that hasn't come up but kind of has been alluded to was duty. That knowing that it's all going to come back and have to do what's in front of us. So rather than taking time to remember, try and find out what it was that caused it all, it's right there in front of you to work on.
And it's a good point. We all should practice, or we all could practice, ways of expressing karma and reincarnation when we're talking to family and friends who may have other belief systems. There are creative ways we can come up with to express it. Certainly karma, action and reaction, science has proved it. Well, doesn't that apply to us? Aren't we part of this world? We can get creative with that. We have time for one more.
Yeah. Yes. Perhaps the biggest thing we get from this morning's meeting isn't so much as what did I do. It's more of what am I doing?
What am I doing? Absolutely. And what didn't I do that perhaps I should have? Well, one can realize for himself his own ignorance and quickly or slowly gain real knowledge. He may realize what past lives must have been from the nature and strength of the difficulties he encounters in the struggle. It is enough if he sees the real goal and ever struggles towards it. And it will be well for him if he thinks not at all of his own progress, but of what he can do to help others progress. To live to benefit mankind is the first step. Meeting adjourned.
So at this point, I was just